In our last matter this morning, 2023-0572, in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Michael Jones. On behalf of the court, we would like to thank Judge Betsy Looper Schuster from the 10th District Court of Appeals, who is sitting today in Justice Dieter's seat.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here, Judge. We appreciate your assistance. On behalf of the appellant, Mr. Donovan. Good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. Well, I believe that the court's reliance on evidence outside the record is clear and obvious and presents an obvious error. I don't think that that needs to be the focus today, because that is well-settled law. That is long and always been a bedrock principle of appellate review. Rather, I'd like to focus my argument on the court's changing of the standards for ineffective assistance of counsel claims and for the state's inevitable discovery argument that it raised. First and foremost, in motions to suppress, there has long been and always been a distinction between the failure to file a motion and the failure to raise specific issues. As Xenia V. Wallace shows, that if a motion is filed, specific issues are raised and litigated and ruled on by the court. Subsequently, in direct appeal, those issues are subject to a waiver analysis. And that should have been the case here. However, the lower court instead elected to ostensibly apply the standard for the failure to file a motion. And the standard for failure to file a motion, as universally accepted, is: had those issues been raised before the lower court and litigated, the motion, there's a reasonable probability that the motion would have been granted. And that is an exceptionally high hurdle to reach, particularly when the issue is not raised and therefore the evidence in the record is almost always going to be insufficient to properly address those issues. However, what the lower court did in its decision is it then ruled that because there was a reasonable basis, because there was arguable merit, and that raising these issues wouldn't have been futile, that that was sufficient to carry its burden. Arguable merit and lack of futility have never been the standard. This court has ruled, I believe it was in Taylor, that counsel is not required to raise every arguably meritorious claim in order to be effective.
Could you spend some time addressing why we have jurisdiction to hear this case? I mean the Court of Appeals didn't render a judgment, did they? They retained jurisdiction. So is it a final order that can be appealed to us?
I believe that it is, because what it does is it has the final appealable order that was appealed to this to the first district has now been ruled upon effectively, and what they have asked the lower court to do, and this kind of gets to the heart of the appropriateness of the remand order in the first place, which is the first district, in ordering remand, has ordered the defendant to file a motion to suppress and has ordered them to raise specific issues and has ordered the lower court to rule on these issues, all the while ostensibly leaving open this appeal. And
they've left the conviction intact. Have you ever heard of that? I've never heard of that before.
No, sir, and I haven't either. And counsel in his reply brief cites to a couple of cases where there are limited remands, but in all of those cases, the appeal that was before the court is closed out, as it were. There's a ruling on the weight and sufficiency in this case, and then I believe there was also a Reagan-Tokes issue, which now this court has decided in the intervening issues. But in terms of the weight and sufficiency, leaving that open, I believe, is unprecedented.
So it's like essentially sending it back to the trial court and saying, asking them to engage in a thought experiment and engage in a suppression hearing and consider something that has already proceeded to verdict.
Yes, but even beyond that, it's not even, you know, asking, it's ordering.
Right.
The defendant in this case has been ordered to file a new suppression motion and has been ordered to raise these issues. And ironically, in making this order, the court says the reason that this is necessary is because the record wasn't sufficient to review it. Well, if the record's not sufficient to review it, then you shouldn't have engaged in this in the first place. And this goes beyond the fact that the court's ruling in reaching this determination, I mean, I was going to skip over the evidence outside the record, but has clearly based its entire decision on evidence outside the record. And that is such obvious error. And when the state filed for reconsideration, the response from the court was, we couldn't raise that issue for the first time on appeal. That somehow the court being bound by the evidence in the record is waived by us not raising it. And I didn't. I didn't raise that issue in my appellate brief. That's accurate. I wouldn't think that I would have to remind the court that it is bound by the record. And so it's concerning that it has effectively ruled that that issue can be waived, and now it's open, you know, it's fair game, anything that's put before it.
When you're saying in the record, are you limiting that to what was used in the actual hearing, at trial court? What wasn't what they considered part of the record?
No, sir. I would disagree with that. That has never been my understanding of what the characterization is. What I have to assume has happened, because I haven't been able to engage in conversation with the judges in the First District who wrote this. In the record, there were two and only two videos that were ever asked to be admitted into the record.
Mm-hmm.
At the motion to suppress, there were two videos. I believe it was Officers Knapp and Clarkson. And they were short clips in which they briefly addressed Mr. Gaston his consent. And in that clip, Mr. Gaston says, I'm not the owner, I just live here. And that was what was relevant to the issues that were raised. Those are the only two clips that were played. So all of the facts about the protective sweep and the announcing of a warrant, and I'm not even sure, having reviewed the different clips, where the court came up with that Mr. Gaston was in handcuffs for 2 hours, I have no idea where that fact came from.
Yeah,
none of that was legally admitted into the record.
Well, where did they get that from? Did they watch the entire thing? Do you assume that's what's happened?
That is my assumption, and I, you know, I think it's a good assumption, and counsel, I believe, would agree. There's some discrepancy on how many videos were on that disc, but they reference watching other body camera videos. And the disc that was provided in discovery had additional videos on it. That is the only possible location for that.
Did that get admitted into evidence?
The physical DVD with those additional videos was admitted into evidence, but the trial court made clear at the motion to suppress hearing that it was accepting it for those two videos that were played. Counsel said, I'd ask you to accept it for these two videos. Court says, I will accept it for the videos of Officers Knapp and Clarkson. At trial, there is a video is played, but it is never identified. There are slight descriptions, and it is never asked to be admitted into the record, so we don't know which video that was. Additionally, there was a brief discussion before that video was played as to, and it was a visiting judge that was ultimately hearing the trial, and there was a discussion about that. I assume that my predecessor had, I apologize, I'm not addressing the entire court. I assume that my predecessor had reviewed all of these videos. I don't see that it's relevant, but I'll let you play this one. So there's no indication in the record, one, that the trial court, when it addressed the suppression issue, that it reviewed any other videos, and it would not have been appropriate for it to do so. But two, it's my only explanation. I grant that it is speculative, but it is the only logical explanation that I can come up with for where the court came up with all of these facts to say that the video shows this, the video shows this, when none of those videos were ever admitted into the record.
So I want to go back to Justice DeWine's question.
Yes, ma'am.
How do we even reach that question if they did not reverse, affirm, or modify a judgment? They did not touch the underlying conviction. They didn't reverse the judgment of the trial court. They didn't affirm the judgment of the trial court. They didn't modify the judgment. They did nothing with the judgment, which is their only authority under the Ohio Constitution, right? That's their power, reverse, affirm, or modify a judgment. Without that, how is this a viable case here?
I would say, Your Honor, that if the court wishes to, well, obviously the court does wish. So my argument would be that the ruling that the First District did and its remand order is, there is no authority for the remand order. So it is not, absent this court stepping in and making that ruling, there is no option but to adhere to and follow.
Why not file a writ of prohibition? Or, I mean, here we have a court of appeals that's doing something it clearly has no authority to do. So could the state file an extraordinary writ?
Perhaps that would have been an appropriate avenue. As addressed, this is new territory. Never addressed a court making such a ruling, and since their ultimate opinion was so blatantly based on improper material, the decision was made to pursue an appeal. The questioning of whether or not it was a final appealable order did not come until after briefing had been, you know, in counsel's reply brief. Therefore, at that point, it was beyond my ability to. The court wouldn't have had jurisdiction on the prohibition.
You could file original action in this court if you wanted to.
I guess that is possible, sir. And perhaps that's the path that we should have taken. However, I would go back to that. It's necessary for this court to, we would argue that it's necessary for this court to intervene and vacate that opinion because it is, one, the remand order is so outside the scope of the court's authority, and it is necessary to address those issues.
So that's the main reason that you're here?
The main reason that we filed is not the first issue and the evidence outside the record. It's the dilution of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims that effectively provides a master key to unlock otherwise waived issues at a lower standard. Arguable merit and lack of futility has never been the standard for applying those, and then also the court's insertion in inevitable discovery of a requirement that there be evidence in the record that officers were seeking to obtain a warrant. That has never been a requirement. It is absolutely strong evidence that they would have sought one otherwise, but it has never been a requirement. And the court's ruling specifically says there, before inevitable discovery is appropriate, there must be evidence in the record that officers were independently seeking to obtain a warrant. That has never been a requirement, and now it is one in the First District, unless and until this court addresses that issue in the First District.
But with the First District staying, sua sponte staying, pretty much other points raised in the appeal, I go back to what Justice DeWine and Chief Justice Kennedy said, which is this prematurely here?
The only thing, you know, the only thing left that I can say on that is that, you know, the procedural, I guess if the court wants to find that it was improvidently, the appeal was improvidently granted and remand back, we would then be in a position of filing a writ of prohibition and coming back before the court to address whether or not the court had authority to make the order that it is. I guess I would make an argument that in the interest of judicial economy, if the court thinks that that was the appropriate path to go down, since the issue is before the court, we would ask you to address that, the legality of the remand order. And then if the court, if the lower court then closes out the appeal and sends it back, then we'll, and leaves the other issues intact, then we will promptly file the appeal again and attempt to come back and litigate this issue. But it shows a clear departure from the applicable standards, and we would ask you to address those issues today. I'm assuming I'm, if not at my time, I'm close to it.
You're red.
Very good. I would reserve the remainder then.
Thank you. Mr. Hoffman.
Please the court, Chief Justice Kennedy.
Can you start with what Justice DeWine asked first?
Yes, Your Honor. This court is constitutionally limited in its jurisdiction to review final orders.
Well, is it?
But didn't the
appellate court? Well, hold on. Let me ask my question.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
I mean, is it limited?
I believe I found
under,
a constitution.
Under what provision of the Constitution?
I don't have that in front of me, Your Honor. And I don't have it in my mind. But I did do research on it and found limitations. It was actually a case I found, a case law.
Okay. I know Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution gives us jurisdiction in cases, in appeals and felony cases for leave first obtained. There's no final order requirement in that provision, anyway.
Well,
it doesn't say final order,
anyway. Sorry, Judge.
It doesn't say final order in there.
It does not say it, no. I had to do research and find a case that said it, but it was one of this court's cases that held that it was, that the orders had to be final.
What gave the Court of Appeals the authority to order a suppression hearing on issues that they wanted heard that weren't in the record, and then hold control of the case until that was held? What authority is there for that?
Well, that was in the remand instructions.
No, but where did they get the authority to issue that instruction?
Well, it happens. Courts do remand cases from time to time with instructions, and the lower courts follow the instructions.
Maybe it happens on a sentencing issue, maybe, but I've never heard of an appellate court sending back, allowing the convictions to remain intact and asking them to decide upon an issue that gets decided before trial even begins. I've never heard of that before. Is there any precedent for that?
Well, in my brief, I found a case, a remand in the context of a motion to suppress, but that was for findings. It was a remand so the trial court could make the findings that were not made so that the court could review it. But the reopening the evidentiary part of a motion to suppress, I found no precedent for that.
That precedent you found asked the court to look back at what they already did and make findings, not engage in another.
A new hearing.
That's correct. Well, in the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals put this in their opinion. The state repeatedly claimed that the record wasn't sufficient for the court to rule upon the two omitted claims. That's the sweep search and the consent search. And the suggestion was made that there might be facts out there that would justify the sweep and show that the consent was not coerced. It was freely and voluntarily given. And that was repeatedly mentioned. And the court, I believe, took the state up on it.
But counsel, the fact that that was the position, doesn't that give rise to a post-conviction petition as opposed to the appeal that was taken here if there's evidence outside the record that needs to be considered by the court?
I believe that the record contained evidence of the omitted recordings. It was transmitted to the Court of Appeals. I agree that only 2 of the 10 recordings were admitted into evidence, and only 2 of the 10 recordings were played at the hearing on the motion to suppress. But on page 379 to pages 379 to 383 of the trial transcript, the successor trial judge stated on the record that the motion hearing judge reviewed all the recordings. So it was before the court. The court viewed them. And another thing, a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel on the basis of a failure to produce evidence at the trial court level can be raised in a direct appeal as long as the evidence as long as the record shows or contains or demonstrates the existence of the omitted evidence. So
doesn't the lawyer it's found by the court to have been ineffective assistance of counsel. They don't order the case back to the trial court with, oh, we want to have this additional evidence put in the record.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Are you okay with what the trial court, what the appellate court did in this instance? So the conviction is still intact, correct?
That is correct. They did not set aside the conviction.
So the correct conviction is still intact. They remand to the trial court for presentation of evidence because finding that it wasn't sufficient, or I shouldn't say sufficient, but not adequate here, go back for a hearing, order you, your client, to either file another suppression motion or order a hearing to then, and I guess you're expected to appeal again if the decision doesn't come out the way you want, to then go back to the court, or as the court is maintaining jurisdiction, to then evaluate whether the evidence at this remand hearing is appropriate? I mean, is that what this all is, and you're okay with that?
if the court found that the omitted evidence,
if it's not there on appeal, if the court found deficiencies when it was before it on appeal, what should the court have done? I mean, shouldn't the conviction have been reversed?
Yes, that's my position. Reverse the conviction, send it back for new proceedings, new motion to suppress hearing, new trial.
But that didn't happen.
It did not happen.
And
that's correct.
And you didn't appeal that?
No. I did not appeal that. No.
Which comes to my question, does the state even have standing to argue this proposition on appeal? Because it seems that, that we've got case law that says it's fundamental that an appeal lies only on behalf of the party aggrieved. What you've just said is essentially the remand was really more for the benefit of the state, because the state said there may be other evidence out there, and so the Court of Appeals said, okay, go back, produce that evidence at the suppression hearing, and let us know what happens.
Well, our position that it was pretty clear there wasn't any evidence out there. It was the timestamps. William Gaston was on that porch for 2 hours before he was presented with that consent to search. In a sweep search taken 2 hours, and also there was no suggestion that anyone was being harbored in that house at the time they decided to do the sweep. I mean, it was just, I don't think it no skin off my nose to have that thing come back in for a hearing. That's the position I'm taking.
Which means that if anybody would be complaining about the remand, it would be the state, because you're certain there's no other evidence out there.
Yes, I think the court was calling their bluff.
Thanks.
You're welcome. So the fact that the 8 recordings were not admitted into evidence, it's not crucial in this case. It isn't the trial court's action or inaction that's being challenged, or its ruling on the motion to suppress. It's trial counsel's omissions. And so the relevance of this evidence that's in the appellate record, it doesn't depend upon whether the trial court viewed it, admitted it into evidence. The importance of it is that it was omitted, that trial counsel didn't use it. And the evidence of this omitted, of these omitted recordings is in the appellate record. It was transmitted to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals could view it. It's the same thing as if a discovery response included statements. And then on appeal, the Court of Appeals looked at that. It might not have been entered into evidence. A trial court might not have seen it, but it might have contained omitted facts that were not used at trial by a trial counsel, and that could be the basis of an ineffective assistance of trial claim on direct appeal.
On direct appeal, you think a court can go outside the record and look at things?
No, that's a part of the record under State versus Blanton.
Okay, but is something that's not admitted into evidence part of the record?
Yes, it could be admitted into evidence. It could be denied admission and proffered, or it could be otherwise contained in the record on appeal. And that's the case I cited in with the additional authorities was a post-conviction case. They found that was res judicata because those documents attached to the discovery response were in part of the record on appeal.
Were the other 8 videos proffered?
No, they were not.
What's anybody got a right to look at them?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Then what gives anybody a right to look at them?
Because they were submitted and transmitted to the Court of Appeals without any objection from trial, the prosecutor or request that only the two recordings that were admitted be put on a DVD and submitted. The Court of Appeals, the prosecutor, and defense counsel on appeal all had a working assumption that those were part of the appellate record. This court is the first court to have a chance to determine whether that's part of the record or not. The Court of Appeals didn't have a chance to do it. It was forfeited, this claim about being outside the record on appeal. The standard for ineffective assistance of counsel is that the prejudice prong, at least, it has to be demonstrated by a reasonable probability that had the counsel acted differently, the outcome would be different. A reasonable probability is the test. And
Counselor, I don't think anybody debates the second prong. I think the issue is the first prong, and whether the attorney would have to show a meritorious claim as opposed to a potentially meritorious claim.
I guess I don't understand the question.
So there's two parts of the Strickland test.
Right.
The first part is whether the attorney acted consistent with the attorney's responsibilities. And in that case, you have to say that had they raised those issues, they would have been successful. And then the second prong is that there is a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different. Is that correct?
My understanding is that's all the second prong. I thought that the first prong was it's an objective test, and it's a standard, reasonable standard of representation. If their conduct fell below that standard, then you've got the first prong. The second prong is prejudice, and you have to prove that a different outcome. If the conduct had not been engaged in, or the act or omission had not been in existence, then you'd have a different outcome.
So how do you show deficient conduct then?
Deficient conduct, well.
How do you show that those issues should have been raised if you don't show that those issues would have been successful?
Well, I guess they go hand in hand. I think they would have been successful. I think I think it's clear from the record that the sweep was not justified, that the consent was coerced. I don't understand. I think it's pretty clear that under any standard, a near certainty that if these claims had been raised, that they would have been found to have merit.
Then why did the trial court remand?
Well, I think that it was because of the claim that the record was not sufficient to rule on it. This claim about the 8 recordings not being a part of the appellate record wasn't part of that analysis, though. That wasn't raised until it properly raised before this court. Um, the inevitable discovery claim in this case is based upon speculation. As I said before, William Gaston was on that porch for 2 hours in handcuffs, and there was no claim that any attempt was made to go anywhere to get a warrant. There was no attempt made. There was a claim that they had probable cause that, so that if they wanted to get a warrant, they could have. But I don't think this court wants to be able to sanction warrantless residence searches based upon an after-the-fact conclusion of a judge that there was probable cause and they could have obtained a warrant. It just when it comes to residence searches, the police can't just speculate. I mean, yes, make a speculative claim that they could have obtained a warrant. There should be procedures in place and implemented at the time of the illegal discovery of the evidence. And that's what the rules should be for inevitable discovery. If there are no further questions, I would ask that this court would find that it does not have jurisdiction over this case. And I do
have one more question.
Yes.
Is there anything in evidence that the officers had a good faith belief that there was a valid exception to the warrant requirement to search the house?
Good faith requirement. I don't think so. I think they relied upon that consent.
Which was obtained after they did the search.
Well, they did the sweep search, and then before they did the evidence search, I think what I mean by evidence search is when they seized the safe.
Right.
The safe was discovered during the sweep search.
Right. The sweep search, you said, took 2 hours.
Yes. And then they returned to the porch, took the handcuffs off of Mr. Gaston. He signed the consent form. And then they retrieved the safe. And then they made a search warrant so the safe could be opened.
Was it a sweep search or was it in actuality a search?
I would say it was an invalid sweep search. They noted the safe in the recording. You can see they mentioned it during the sweep, but I think that it was an invalid sweep search because there was a lack of evidence that in the house there somebody was being harbored that could cause danger. At the time of the decision to do the sweep, there was no evidence that a person was being harbored inside the residence that could cause present a danger to the officers during the evidence search.
Thank you.
There was also some debate earlier about the 2 hours. What evidence outside of the 8 other videos was there that was 2 hours?
Okay, I say I'm out of time, but I'll go ahead and there were timestamps on these videos and
on the 2 or on the 8?
On the unadmitted, the ones that were not admitted.
Okay, but not
those
on
time
the 2.
Stamps. That's correct.
Okay. So the 2 hour issue didn't exist if the 8 hadn't been viewed.
Well, I want to retract
that's what I'm trying
that.
To find
just
out.
A little bit. The two videos that were played were right before the sweep search, where they come out and they talk to him, and then the second short video that was played was after the sweep search, and so the timestamps on those two may have constituted the 2 hours on
Did
the
they?
Two that were admitted.
Okay.
It might be.
Okay.
I'm not sure, but
I
watched them all, but I didn't pay attention to the timestamps.
Okay, thank you.
All right, you're welcome. No further questions asked that the court would dismiss. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Donovan.
I only have a couple of moments. I'd like to clarify something really quick, Justice Fisher, on that issue. That's absolutely incorrect. The two videos show the exact same moment, which is ostensibly post-protective sweep. Both show the exact same moment, which is the signing of the consent form before the search is conducted. Without being able, and my entire argument is that it's improper to refer to the 8 videos, so without being able to refer to those, I can't address the 2 hour window that keeps being repeated and keeps being repeated and keeps being repeated, other than to say that there's absolutely no basis for that time in anything that's in the record, and then I will leave it at that in terms of things beyond the record. Beyond that,
The issue as to the court's authority and jurisdiction to hear this case, and I understand that that is always an issue that the court can address and that the court obviously will address in this matter. It was raised as an aside in the procedural posture. I did not respond to that, so I do not have a formal argument with case law and trying to address Judge DeWine.
If we chose to ask you to provide supplemental briefing on that, is that something that you think would be helpful?
I would be happy to research the court's authority on this. However, I would think that we're in a little bit of an exceptional circumstance in that and Justice DeWine, you will respond that we should have done a prohibition. But in the situation where we're in to prevent other courts from taking guidance from the First District and ordering similar remands, and had the court done, ordered it for a remand, vacated the proceeding, said that the motion to suppress was not properly ruled, and we reverted back to step one, we might not be here in this position. But the court
should we just issue a summarily reverse this and order the Court of Appeals to issue a proper decision?
On the spot, my knee-jerk is to say yes. As I explained, this was brought up in the procedural posture. It was not the focus of my research for this, so I do not have a strong basis other than that. Yes, the lower court, the appellate court, only has jurisdiction to address final appealable orders, but I would argue that this court has expanded jurisdiction over decisions of those courts, and I'm unaware of a limitation that would prevent this, but I cannot cite to authority at this point for that because so I know that I'm way over my time, I'm assuming, so I will.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court. Marshall.